We're going to start chapter four today, which is going to be the last chapter, which is really about the sotah before we start talking about something else. But before I started on chapter four, I wanted to circle back to what we talked about with the Nazir yesterday. People were asking about Shimshon and Shmuel as to whether they were a Nazir. I got a haircut, by the way, at home. So it's not a good one, but it does the job. Okay. So we just wanted to circle back. And here is where the Mishnah talks about it. It talks about this additional Nazir. There's the Mishnah has three types of Nazir that it talks about, one of which is the standard Nazir, which is you take an oath for a short period of time. That short period of time is by default 30 days. So you might say, like, I'll take three Nazir periods, in which case that means you'll do it for 180 days or whatever, but essentially every, not 180 days, 90 days, 30 days, 90 days. So the default would be 30 days, but you can also become a Nazir Olam, a permanent Nazir, which is different from a Nazir Shimshon, which is you were a Nazir before you were even born. And they play out the difference here. So somebody who says, I am like Shimshon, or I'm like Ben Manoach, Shimshon Ben Manoach, or I am the husband of Delilah, or I'm like the one who broke the gates of Gaza, or who killed all the who the Philistines cut out their eye. We already saw this person becomes a Nazir Shimshon, becomes a Nazir like Samson was. And what's the difference between becoming a permanent Nazir and a Nazir Shimshon? The difference is a Nazir Olam can every now and again take a little chopper to their hair in order to lighten up the hair. And when they do, they bring the three animals that you have to bring when the Nazir is finished with their time. So even though they continue being a Nazir, they can have sort of mini haircuts and then bring the Korban. Also, if they are impure by touching a corpse, they have to bring the associated sacrifice to atone for the fact that they violated the Nazir terms. But a Nazir Shimshon, there's nothing you can do about the hair. The hair has to grow forever, just like Shimshon. And if you come into contact with a corpse, you don't have to bring a sacrifice at all. This is just kind of practical when it comes to Shimshon, because the thing that Shimshon is known for doing is killing a bunch of Philistines. So if he had to bring a korban every time he did that, that would be a lot of korbanot. So the Nazir Shimshon is exempt from bringing sacrifices for being in contact with corpses. So that's what we were talking about before, that there's the normal kind of Nazir is just the straight up 30-day Nazir, or for some short period of time. Some people would say, let me become a Samson forever. A Samson forever, a Nazir forever. And some people would say, let me become a Samson, a Nazir like Samson. And that would end up with slightly different rules. Okay, so that was just to clarify all of that. Now we're going on to, so we just finished a section on what the difference is between male priests, female priests, and men and women in a bunch of areas of halakha. Now we're coming back to the sotah. And we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about this phrase, the tiste isha tachat isha, which it comes in the verses, talking to the woman that you did the sota, you went astray under her husband. Well, this woman went astray under her husband. So this phrase under her husband is going to be the limiting case in these kind of marriages, which we'll see. You can't really do the sota in these cases, so you're kind of stuck in this in the limbo, which can only end in divorce because there's no way to clarify the doubt. So here you go. Arusa v'shomeret yavam lo shotot v'lo notzlot ketubah shne'amar asher tiste isha tachat isha prat l'arusa v'shomeret yavam. Somebody who is betrothed or waiting for their lever. So in other words, they're waiting for the brother of their deceased husband to either perform chalitza and end the bond, or to get married. So in either of those cases, they neither drink nor do they collect their ketubah. So in other words, if they went through the process of being warned formally before two witnesses by their husband while the husband was alive, and then in the second case, or by their betrothed in the first case, If they, no, actually, sorry, my mistake. That husband dying case comes up later. The Shomeret Yavam case is actually the lever doing it. The person that she has a bond with, the brother, it's the living brother who does it. So her husband has already died. They already had no children. Now the lever comes along and warns her formally about another man. In either of those cases, they die. If she is warned formally and then nonetheless goes and secludes herself with that man, she will neither drink the sota, but she won't connect her ketubah. The marriage ends. She just goes. There's nothing. There's no ceremony. There's no chance of a ceremony. It just ends. And the reason for this is because the Torah says explicitly tachat isha when she's sort of under her husband, which is a detail prat la arusa prat to exclude a detail to exclude a betrothed and. Somebody who's waiting for their lever, because these are not fully under her husband. The betrothed had there's certain rights that kick in when you get betrothed, but it's not full marriage rights. And there are also as a certain bond when it comes to waiting for the lever, but it's not full marriage. Therefore, it only applies to full marriage. That's what they're saying here. You can't do the sota. Again, this is sort of going through the kind of Mishnah's mission in general, which is try to reduce the number of people doing the sota ritual in total. Here is another way to reduce it, which is to use this phrase tachat isha as a limiting factor that has to be a valid marriage and has to be a full marriage. And if none of those things are true, there's no ceremony. There's no way to do the drinking at all. Similarly, other things now, we're going to talk about marriages which are forbidden marriages. Almana l'chohen gadol, grusha v'chalutza l'chohen hetyot, mamzeret unatina li'Yisrael, uvat Yisrael l'mamzer ulunatin, lo shotot v'lo notzlot ketuba. A widow married to a high priest, or a divorcee, or a someone who has gone through the mini-divorce of chalitza with their lever, to a normal priest, those are forbidden marriages according to the Torah. Mamzeret unatina, a mamzeret, a sort of bastard is the way to say it, but it's not total. There's a differing definitions of what exactly mamzeret means, but it's some illicit birth. Natina is also a bit unclear, but it's some kind of descendant of temple slaves, someone else who doesn't have full rights in the Jewish people. So mamzeret and natina Yisrael, that's a forbidden marriage to a normal Jew. A normal Jew is not allowed to marry a mamzeret or a natina, and that goes both ways, and a Jewish woman married to a male mamzer or natin. All of those cases, because they're forbidden marriages, lo shotot v'lo notlot ketubah, they don't come under the tachat isha, they're not really marriages, they're forbidden, and therefore there's no way to do the sota ceremony. So if the husband would in those circumstances warn her, and then she nonetheless secluded herself with that man, that would be the end of the marriage. There's no ketubah payments. That's the end. But also no sota ritual either. Okay. And we're going to continue along this theme. Other situations. Elu lo shotot v'lo notlot ketubah. Other situations where she would not drink and she would not take her ketubah. Ha'omeret t'meya ani. I'm not sure if I explained the take the ketubah thing. The take the ketubah thing is the it's the amount of money. The ketubah at core is a document which the husband gives to the wife, saying, "On the event of my death or divorce, here is the amount of money you will get." So this is just tearing up that contract. It's not the fancy thing that we hang up on the wall today. That's not what they mean by ketubah. Okay. Anyway, so these are the people who don't drink and don't take their ketubah. Ha'omeret t'meya ani, one who says, I am impure, she admits to it. We saw this already earlier on in the Mishnah, but we're just summarizing a bunch of cases here. V'shabau la edim shehi t'meya, or witnesses came to say that she is t'meya, that she did the deed, that would end up into a capital case. There's no point doing the sota, and she doesn't get her ketubah either. V'halmeret eini shota, or somebody who doesn't want to drink. If she decides not to drink, the sota ceremony is cancelled and she doesn't get her ketubah because she's close to admitting guilt. Amar ba'ala eini mashka, v'shebala ba'ale v'aderech, notelet ketubata v'lo shota. But if the husband changes his mind, if the husband withdraws consent and says, I don't want to make her drink, or her husband has sex with her on the way to the court to Jerusalem, then the sotah ceremony is irrelevant, but she gets her ketubah. Essentially, the rule here is, and this rule is in generally true in the Mishnah, that if it's the woman's fault that the marriage ended, woman's fault in whatever way, as a response to the woman's actions, then she doesn't get her ketubah. But if it's the man's fault that the marriage ended, then for sure she gets the ketubah. That's the general rule, and that's what plays out here also. If she admits to it, or she has witnesses that prove it, or she doesn't want to drink, then she loses out. But if the husband changes his mind, or the husband doesn't follow the correct prohibitions of being separate from his wife during this period, then it's the husband's fault, and the husband has to pay the full amount. Okay, now we're going to deal with the issue I alluded to above, but I was wrong about, which is that here we're going to talk about the case of when the husband dies before the ceremony happens. So in other words, the husband has gone through the warning process. She's then secluded with this man, and now they're like off to Jerusalem, and maybe he dies on the way, or he dies before they set out to Jerusalem, or he dies in Jerusalem before the ceremony happens. So what do you do then? What's the deal with the ketubah? Everyone's going to agree that you don't drink the water. There's no way you can make someone drink the sotah without the husband's consent. And given that he's dead, he can't give consent. So everyone agrees that. The question is, whose fault is it to a certain extent? Does she get the ketubah or not? If their husbands died before they drank. Well, you'll see, Judith. Beit Shammai omrim not lot ketubah v'lo shotot. Beit Shammai says they get the ketubah, the wives get the ketubah, but they don't drink. Beit Hillel omrim lo shotot v'lo notot ketubah. They neither drink nor do they get the ketubah. This is, by the way, a pretty common way that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel split on cases of marriage. That in general, Beit Shammai try to favor the wife's rights, and Beit Hillel favor the husband's rights. You'll see this in a bunch of different places. Here is one of them. Beit Shammai think that the wife has rights to the ketubah. It's not totally clear what the basis of this argument is. According to the Talmud, it's about the status of the ketubah as a debt, and therefore Beit Shammai think that the debt is like essentially already paid, and therefore the husband owes it even after he dies. Whereas Beit Hillel thinks it's not a debt which is essentially already paid. So that's how the Talmud understands this debate. Not totally clear to me what the basis of this is, because especially since the rest of the Mishnah we're talking about whose fault is it. So they could be kind of debating like whose fault is it. Beit Shammai think well, kind of his fault that he died, so he should have to pay, or his estate should have to pay. Beit Hillel might be saying, it's an act of God. Like, he would have gone through the ceremony if he wanted to, so the ceremony should count, even though you can't do it. Unclear. Though to be clear, Alexandra, interesting to hear about Shammai and Hillel's split on the ketubah here. To be clear, I don't know what Shammai and Hillel's positions are on the ketubah. I just know what Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai's positions are on the ketubah. The reason I'm making a distinction is because sometimes they disagree with each other, and people are unclear. It's an annoying nitpicky thing, but people make this blurry mistake all the time. There's cases where you have like Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, and then Shammai comes along and disagrees with both opinions above. So it's not clear to me at all what the relationship is between Beit Shammai and Shammai, or Beit Hillel and Hillel. Someone could do that work and try to work out if there is a relationship. I have not seen anyone do that, so I don't know what it is. We almost always follow Beit Hillel. So I would assume that would be the case here, but I actually don't know for sure. And also it's unlikely to come up. Let me just check. The Kahati normally tells you who the halakha follows, the Kahati commentary. He doesn't even mention this. Presumably it's because it's Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, and Beit Hillel normally win. Okay. So assuming Beit Hillel gets halakha. And that's the case in a lot of these debates around the ketubah. Now, here's another case of other cases of sort of questionably forbidden marriages. So we saw before a whole list of unambiguously forbidden marriages. Here are sort of forbidden marriages for which there is sort of some remedy, depending on who you ask. And therefore, there's a debate about whether these women go through the sota ceremony or not, whether it's covered by, as I said again, this verse, tachat isha, under her husband. Mu'uberet chaveiro, umeneket chaveiro, lo shotot v'lo notzlot ketubah, divrei Rabbi Meir. So there's someone, a woman who is pregnant with someone else's child. In other words, like she was married to someone else. She was pregnant with that person and then married someone else while she was still pregnant. Got divorced from the first guy, married a new guy. Or someone who is nursing a child who belongs to someone else. Lo shotot v'lo notot ketubah. They don't drink and they don't take their ketubah, according to Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir thinks that these marriages are forbidden. And in general, like the Chachamim prefer for a man not to marry someone who is pregnant from another woman, pregnant from another man, or nursing another person's child. Partly, the justification given in Ketubot is because of the sakana, because of the danger. That's not totally obvious, the danger to whom, from whom. There's a bunch of ways you can understand that. One way is that you can understand the danger to the child in the sense that the husband has no intrinsic motivation to look after the child from another man or to allow his wife to nurse another child, and therefore the child is in danger. That I think is probably the clearest reading. You're supposed to wait a number of years, around 2 years after marriage, after being pregnant or after finishing, after being pregnant. You're supposed to wait 2 years between marriages in order that you can like leave enough time to nurse the child fully. They expect you, there's a debate also in Ketubot about how long you're supposed to nurse your child, but it's somewhere between 18 months and 2 years is their general understanding. So therefore 2 years gives you enough time to basically nurse the child and be done with it before you can get remarried. So if you were to marry in the interim, Rabbi Meir holds that's essentially a forbidden marriage. There's nothing you can do about it. So there's no sota ritual. It's not tachat isha. It's not, there's not a full marriage. Is not covered by the verses about this ritual. However, Chachamim Omrim, the Chachamim point out that this is not a totally forbidden marriage in the same way that the other marriages of invalid statuses of like some kind of bastard being married to a full citizen, it's not the same kind of invalid marriage. Because yachol hu lahafrisha ulahachzira la'achar zman, it is possible to separate from her and then return her after the right amount of time. So Chachamim are saying there's actually a remedy in this scenario to making it a valid marriage. The remedy is wait 2 years, right? All you have to do is divorce her now, wait 2 years, take her back after 2 years. So it's not a forbidden marriage in the sense of the other forbidden marriages. It's a marriage for which there is some kind of remedy. And therefore, according to the Chachamim, it seems, she can be made to drink the waters because it is a valid marriage. It's not an invalid marriage in the way the others are because there is some kind of remedy to do it, even if he doesn't actually do that remedy, right? This doesn't require a man who married someone who is pregnant with another man's child. It doesn't require that person to actually divorce his wife and wait 2 years and remarry. All it's saying is because he has the ability to do that, it is a valid marriage, and therefore the sota would apply. To that circumstance, she would be able to drink the waters. Similarly, another kind of questionably invalid marriage: Ilonit uskena ushena ruya leled lo shotot velo notzlot ketuba. An ilonit is a woman who never had the marks of female sexual maturity and therefore is unable to bear children. Zakena also, presumably Zakena as in old, beyond the age of childbearing, and She'ina Ru'yalelet, someone who's not appropriate to give birth for whatever reason. This is just like the catch-all, like Ilonit and Zakena are really two examples of someone who is not able to give birth. Lo shotot v'lo notlot ketuba. They shouldn't drink and shouldn't drink their ketuba. So this is, again, so there's I'm going to read this the way I think Rabbi Eliezer understood this, and then I'm going to give you an alternate way I think you can actually understand this a little bit. But the way you fit it in with the invalid marriage situation is because you have to have children for a marriage. These are kind of questionably forbidden marriages if you're a man to marry a woman who can't bear children. You are obligated in procreation as a man, and therefore this is a questionably forbidden marriage. And therefore there's no way to make her go through the sota ceremony because it's not really tachat isha, it's not really a full marriage. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Yachol hu lisa isha acheret v'lifrot v'lirbot heimena. Rabbi Eliezer again points out that this is not a totally forbidden marriage in the way that the other mamzer and natin stuff was a forbidden marriage, because just like the first case where a man is able to divorce the pregnant his pregnant wife and then remarry her after 2 years, here too he has a remedy, he has a way out. He can actually marry another wife. Men can marry multiple wives. So it's not a forbidden marriage. He could just marry someone else and then get v'lifrot v'lirbot heimena, have children from her, peria uvia, from her, to like the verbal form of be fruitful and multiply. So again, it's not an invalid marriage because he could find another way to fulfill his mitzvah of having children by marrying someone else. So again, the first opinion here seems to be like, this is a little bit an invalid marriage. And the second part is, it's not really an invalid marriage, it's actually a valid marriage. Andy, I just want to be clear about what's going on here. I think it is all about abusing the women and stealing her ketubah payment. What's going on here is not about really the ketubah payment. That's not what really matters here. What matters here is the lo shotot, the fact that she can't go through the sota ceremony. That's what we're dealing with here. What we're dealing with here is trying to reduce the number of people who can go through the sota ceremony. Now, there might also, like, once, and the way the Mishnah thinks about this, it's not a spin. I think it's literally what we're talking about. The way the Mishnah understands this is that she, and this is the part which you can disagree with, and this is the part which I think you could definitely argue is morally questionable. What they're saying is that once a man has warned the woman and then she's gone and secluded with that man anyway, it's essentially her fault that the marriage dissolves and therefore she doesn't get the ketubah payment. That's the part where you can't really spin nicely. And I'm not trying to spin it at all. That's the way they understand. That's the not law, not law ketubah. But the law shotot is the key part of this, which is the point is these are not valid marriages, according to some people, and therefore there would be no way to do the sota ceremony. Did they do this so they can get out of a sota ceremony? Yeah, well, I don't know. Probably not. This is, again, we've seen this a couple of times. This is a kind of Mishnah which is extremely careful, just a careful reading of the Pesukim. So all we know about the sota ceremony is from the Pesukim. So they're just reading it very carefully. They're reading Tachat Isha under her husband, and they're working out all of these cases which must be excluded from that scenario. Very close reading. Do I remember correctly that a miscarriage is the sign of a woman's guilt in sota? If so, then a woman who can't become pregnant is not subject to the sota, it seems to me. Barbara, yes. So that's what I was going to say, the second explanation. So it's once Rabbi Eliezer comes along and says that he is able to fix the problem in another way, it must be that that he understood this first line to be about valid or invalid marriages, because he comes with the same kind of argument that the Chachamim came up over here. But I did want to say there was another way to understand this line, which is that it's just the sota ceremony is just not relevant to someone who can't bear children. The whole framework of sota is about children. It's about, like I was arguing to you, that the pshat of the verses is that she is pregnant at the time, and that's how her husband starts getting jealous of her, that the reward is having children, and the punishment is miscarriage. So like the whole concept only applies to women who have children. So that's an alternate way to read this line, Ailonit uzakeinah usheina rugala leid, lo shatov v'nolabal ketubah. But you can't read that anymore once you get Rabbi Eliezer. Once Rabbi Eliezer comes, he's put it into the same framework as the first case, which is these are sort of invalid marriages. If she can't have children, why won't the husband need to marry someone else anyway? So yes, that's exactly Rabbi Eliezer's argument, Dan. But what Rabbi Eliezer is saying is that doesn't make that an invalid marriage. Also, like for another example is, you you could, as a man, already have had children, and then later on, marry an Ilonit or Zakena or someone who's not able to give birth, and that would be totally fine. So it's not an invalid marriage in all situations. So Andy, what I was saying, Sotah was required of women who weren't pregnant at the time. How could a non-pregnant woman miscarry? So yeah, so what I'm saying is, what I think the pshat of the verses is that she is pregnant and therefore the punishment is miscarriage. I'm not sure that that's how the Mishnah understands it in any way. The Mishnah may understand it to be much broader, and could, because they also understand, remember that they also understand the kin'ah, the jealousy, to be about a formal warning procedure rather than jealousy of carrying another child. So that's their whole framework is different. So yeah, so the miscarriage stuff is really how I think the pshat of the verses are. Not clear that the Mishnah thinks that. The Mishnah seems to think it just means death to a certain extent. But nonetheless, I still think that is a possible way to think about this line, which is to say that the whole rhetoric of Sotah is all about children, so it doesn't make any sense to apply it to people who can't have children. Okay, yeah, so I don't know for sure whether the Mishnah thinks that's Peshat of the Torah or not. it's actually not totally clear to me. I think the Mishnah might not think that, but I'm not totally sure either way. I could be persuaded if anyone else has any thoughts about that. Okay, Ushar Kol Hanashim, and this is now just like the summary line to remind us of the normal rule, or Shotot or Lo Notlot Ketubah. They either drink or they don't take their ketubah. So that's just sort of summarizing things that we've already seen a few times, which is that the whole point of the Sotah ceremony is if it turns out that she is to clarify the doubt. If it turns out that she's guilty, she'll be dead. If it turns out that she's innocent, she should certainly get her ketubah, because her husband maligned her for no reason. It's odd that the rabbis invest so much effort in this law, considering Mishnah Sotah 9:9 and the cancellation of the whole procedure. I would clarify that and say it's odd that the Mishnah spends so much time on anything which doesn't exist. Like, for example, entire sixth of the Mishnah is about the temple service. Why would you invest so much effort into describing the layout of the second temple? Of all the sacrifices they're not doing anymore. There's a whole, the question is much deeper than Sotah. So whatever the Mishnah is doing, they believe that the investigation of these laws and like the really understanding of these laws is some kind of good in and of itself, regardless of whether they are being enacted or not. And that leaves you up to a whole range of debates about what they're doing, which is hard to take a side on, because they basically don't give you any evidence either way. We are going to, I think, stop there.